Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
Phoenix File. Authorized executive eyes only.
The Phoenix File. Cheviot. Head of Network 23. Edison Carter. The world's top telejournalist. Murray, his hotshot producer. Theora Jones, his oh-so-clever controller. And Max Headroom, the world's first and only computer-generated person. They are all about to regret the day they conspired against Ned Grossberg. Because I have a story that will not only make us top network, it will destroy each and every one of these people. And with them, Network 23.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Labour Party Oxford economist and Irish Republican Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. More shocking evidence this week. Boeing knew the 737 MAX was a death trap, but were more concerned about their reputation than passengers' lives. Not the first time either. Fake parts being installed on Boeings, but no action being taken to stop them. Instead, the whistleblower was sacked. Plus, as more emerges about the mass killer who shall not be named, what was going on at the same time as the mass shooting in Christchurch? What countries have issued threats against New Zealand and why? Plus the latest David Kelly death book from 2003. What's emerged about the reasons for the killing of a government scientist at the height of the Iraq war, WMD lies, and how the killing was covered up. And the Rothschild anti-Semitic trope. What is a trope, and what's the facts behind the so-called wealth of the Rothschild family? Is it legitimate to single them out despite the fact that they're Jewish? Plus, from the Israeli Security Cabinet, Moshe Kalon, the secretive finance minister. What does he have to say about the Israeli state's biblical history and rights? And what about the Christian Zionists in America? What are they saying to encourage him? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, Tuesday at noon. This week, the Easter Holidays School of Activism at the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. Also, Paul Hazelden from Bristol Multi-Faith Forum explaining how close they are to the social ills of poverty and homelessness affecting the city, what they're doing about it, and who can and can't join them. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now. Help me start this week, Martin, with the shocking evidence about Boeing. This is the 737 MAX. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about this is because quite a lot has been emerging just over the last... I mean, it was happened nearly 2 weeks ago, this Ethiopian Airlines crash. It took nearly a week for the 737 MAX to be grounded, but it's now absolutely clear that Boeing pilots have been reporting this problem with the plane going into a nosedive just after takeoff and starting to nose down and then not be able to control it for months since this plane was introduced. In fact, pilots have been saying there's a serious problem with this plane. Please sort it out. They were totally ignored.
Well, as you said, Tony, what looks to be happening here is that instead of dealing with the problem, they're trying to cover it up in order to protect their reputation. And, of course, you saw this is corporate malfeasance. You know, Ralph Nader, the consumer campaigner in the US, made his name in the 70s, pointing out that GM were very, very well aware that the models of their cars were death traps because they exploded when they crashed. But instead of trying to fix it, they spent a lot of money trying to prevent it wasn't happening and to sue people who pointed it out.
But the international airline travel, that could spell disaster for Boeing. There's, I suppose, two major things here is that there are many other Boeing aircraft in the similar sort of management structure, and people will be concerned that maybe a Boeing simply isn't safe. But also there's this whole idea of autonomy. This is some sort of autonomous system that kicks in and overrides the pilot. We're living in an age now where billions and billions Musk, for example, and Tesla cars. It's not just in aviation. This whole idea is being sold to the public that we can have autonomous cars, autonomous aircraft on a massive scale, and this punctures a hole right through that.
Well, yes. I mean, I don't know enough about the technical details to say whether it's viable or not, but obviously from an economics point of view, if you're going to robotise everything, the question is, where's the working class going to get its salaries from, and how are you going to make the economy work?
Well, that's another aspect to it, but it seems that they're in denial, and big time, about whether these robotised technologies, whether it's aircraft, trucks, trains, cars, whatever, whether it's safe.
Well, I think that's obviously the obvious thing to point to make is that once you've got chips basically making decisions, those chips are hackable. So, for example, some years ago, Hezbollah in Lebanon, when they were accused of the Hariri assassination, they said, we don't really want to do this, we've given too much away, but we're going to give you the video feed from the Israeli drone, which we think was responsible for this, because we've hacked the Israeli system. So, in other words, the Israeli military had a whole system in place, and of course, Hezbollah's job is just to hack into it, but not tell them that they've hacked into it. So you could get a situation where, you know, you fire your cruise missiles at, say, a Russian airbase, and they just hack into the system and say, go back and attack your, you know, missile fly home to where you were fired from. And of course, that's the problem with all of these systems, is that they're hackable.
We had a whole situation with the Trident submarine missile test, didn't we, a couple of years ago, with by the Royal Navy in the Atlantic Ocean, where the Trident missile, even though it didn't actually have a nuclear warhead on it, thank God, went off in the opposite direction and started heading to California. Yes. Now, one does wonder if someone is having a bit of a laugh there and hacking into their Trident submarine computer system.
Well, it's a problem. It's a for military people, it's a big problem, because you've got a sophisticated system which is dependent, highly dependent upon these kind of networks, and those networks are hackable. The Stuxnet virus, which was used to take down the Iranian nuclear industry, and of course the Venezuelans are accusing the Americans of taking down their electricity infrastructure using these methods last week.
So we've got a double trouble for Boeing, really. Not only is the 737 MAX 8 grounded, but they've got to convince people that when they say it's okay to fly, it really is okay to fly. And in fact, any other problem with a Boeing is going to be now put under serious question. Do you think there's anything structural different between the way, say, for example, Airbus run the A380s and A300s, or Boeing and their aircraft? They're the two big...
Well, I don't have enough technical knowledge to determine that, but clearly, again, from an economics point of view, what it shows is that aerospace in particular, it operates on such a large scale that you can't have what you might call straightforward free markets.
Well, Boeing and
system.
Boeing,
you
and
know, you basically it's all political decisions.
Boeing
that decide
and Airbus,
what's going to happen.
Boeing and Airbus have pretty much a monopoly. Almost every aircraft flying around is one
that's
of the
right.
other.
So that is in technical terms a duopoly. So they basically carve the world up between them, and ultimately, you know, that's to do with political struggles between the European Union and the U.S. military industrial complex.
Anyway, I've seen very little really going into the criticism of Boeing on UK media, TV particularly, but RT America did on a show called The Rick Sanchez Show, which is run by the Russian government on US soil. And Rick Sanchez, their reporter, spoke to another reporter, he was actually a news presenter, he spoke to their reporter Rachel Blavens on what the pilots knew but Boeing ignored.
So this is a federal database where airline pilots can go and submit anonymous complaints about experiences that they have when they're flying. And we're talking about this now because the Boeing 737 MAX 8 is in the news. And it turns out that there are a number of airline pilots who have actually submitted complaints about this plane recently that are here in the United States.
And they match pretty much what we've been told about the nose of the plane that may have caused the crashes?
Exactly. So their stories are really eerie because they actually line up with some of the stories that we've seen these deadly crashes from. So let's take a look at a few of the comments that we've seen on this database. So on one of them, a pilot wrote, quote, I looked at an engaged A autopilot as I was returning to my primary flight display. Pilot monitoring called descending, followed by an almost immediate don't sink, don't sink. I immediately disconnected autopilot and resumed climb. Wow. So what he's saying is that they took off, everything was fine, and then they put the plane on autopilot, and all of a sudden the nose just starts diving. And luckily they
were
He didn't want to
go down, but the plane was doing it
on its
own.
Exactly, and it was on autopilot, so it was supposed to have been flying with no problems at all.
Wow.
And luckily, manually, they were able to fix that. But what's really scary is that there's another pilot who has the exact same story.
Wow.
So another pilot wrote in this database, and he said, quote, the aircraft accelerated normally, and the captain engaged the A autopilot after reaching set speed. Within 2 to 3 seconds, the aircraft pitched nose down. I called descending just prior to the ground proximity warning system, sounding don't sink, don't sink again. The captain immediately disconnected the autopilot and pitched into a climb. So we have another similar story. But then there's another account on this database that really calls out the airlines that use these planes and the FAA. And he's saying that the pilots who are flying these planes aren't prepared. And he said, quote, I think it is unconscionable that a manufacturer, the FAA, and the airlines would have pilots flying an airplane without adequately training or ever providing available resources and sufficient documentation to understand the highly complex systems that differentiate this aircraft from prior models. The flight manual is inadequate and almost criminally insufficient.
Wow.
Okay, so that's Rick Sanchez's show with Rachel Blavens, the reporter. Martin is also saying that the pilots were not given any instruction on this plane as to how to use the autopilot and particularly how to keep the thing from nose pitching nose down. I mean, one can imagine that if you're trying to fly an airliner and the thing is suddenly pointing downwards, that actually there would be complete chaos in the cockpit and it would be very difficult to collect your thoughts to regain control of the plane.
Well, I understand that certain countries have grounded these planes and other countries haven't.
I think they've all been grounded now.
Oh, they've all been
finally,
grounded
now. After this time last week, yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously, this is very bad news for Boeing. You know, if you think about what happened with BMW and Volkswagen being charged over diesel emissions and so on, you know, Boeing could be sued and could be bankrupted if it's serious enough, wouldn't they?
Any thoughts on this, Mark?
Well, yeah, we always go, I mean, these tragedies are awful, horrific. People died. People lost their lives. Families have lost their loved ones.
It's two plane loads, about 150 in
each.
Yeah,
you know, and it happened like, you know, almost week after week, or the end of last year and then a couple of, you know, last week. And we see continually, and the total kind of sense of impunity, this the leadership, the people who run these companies all around the world, whether it's the Lloyds thing we talked about before, or whether it's Boeing now, or a million other things we could come up with, or the fact that extremism goes on, whether it be Islamic extremism, Jewish, Israeli extremism, white extremism, whatever it is, they're all being fed this kind of message that it's okay to go out there and treat the world as you want. The human beings are worthless, that, you know, we just live the life. I heard Noam Chomsky talking about Rex Tillerson the foreign secretary, the minister, what do they call it in America?
Yeah. I think he was defense
secretary of state. You know, this is a guy who ran Exxon Oil for 30-odd years. Every year, this guy got an internal report on the state of climate change and the impact of his industry on climate change, of pulling this raw materials out of the earth and the way they're using it. And Noam Chomsky says, here I am, a celebrated linguist who's considered one of the finest kind of linguist philosophers of the 20th century, and I cannot come up with a word which describes how evil these people are. It's beyond, it's not Hitler and Mussolini anymore, or Stalin. We're talking a whole different league. They don't care about their children, they don't care about their grandchildren, and if they don't care about their own families, why would they possibly care about you and me? And we are seeing it across the board. These people think they're going to live forever. They think that we're not important. They think they own the planet. They live on the planet as though they're aliens from another place. And this is something that needs to be...
Martin, isn't there some sort of reason for people like this being propelled into these positions of power?
Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? I mean, those who desire power and wealth and the things of this world, if you like, they make sure that they are propelled up that greasy pole, don't
is
they?
Is it like a drug?
You know, not everybody like wants to be a musician or a critic. You know, the people who really want to go out there and do that stuff, they're the people that put themselves forward, aren't they?
Like a drug?
Well, it is, obviously. I mean, all power corrupts, Lord Acton, all power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
What's that wonderful story, sci-fi story, which starts off, you know, we're 20,000 years in the future and the galaxy is settled all over and there's a president elected once every 7 years, except they're not elected. You know, a massive supercomputer goes through during the 7 years that the president is in power. A supercomputer goes through and picks out the most... the person who will do the job best as the next president of the galaxy. Mm. And there's only one law attached to this thing, is the person cannot refuse, because anybody who suits the job knows that it's an impossible job and doesn't want it, you know. So anybody who agrees to the job is the last person you want. Anybody who says they can run a country, fire their ass.
Okay,
you know?
Well, going back to Boeing, on October 2017, there are a whole bunch of stories around the world about a similar sort of thing to this, where fake paperwork and poor parts were replaced, or the Boeing genuine parts were replaced by these fake parts. Boeing were told about it by a whistleblower and promptly sacked the whistleblower. So this isn't the first time this sort of thing has happened in one of these massive corporations, and I'm no doubt it will be the last. But it just seems a little bit embarrassing to me that our press is really not, and our criminal justice system is not getting to the bottom of this, because if mistakes like this have been made, if people are just simply not doing their jobs in making sure airliners are safe to travel in when they perfectly easily could do, then surely people should be going to jail.
I just want to say one thing. The people who own Boeing, they don't fly in Boeings. They fly in Learjets, so they don't have to worry about anything.
Yes, the Gulfstream and things like that. Absolutely right, Mark. Okay, anyway, so let's just have a look now at the repercussions from the... it literally just happened, hadn't it, as we came on air last week, Martin, over in Christchurch. 100 dead and injured, so it's about 50, just over 50 now have died, and another 50 were hospitalised, seriously injured. What do you make of the New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern's her reaction? What she's saying is that she doesn't want this guy named, which is an interesting angle on it all, isn't it? Because that was partly what he wanted. He wanted to be notorious around the world, and that's why I haven't named him today.
To be honest,
and funnily enough, I gave him the wrong name last week, so he's never been named on this show.
Well, I must admit, I mean, she can say as a sort of moral statement by her that I'm not going to name him in the Parliament and all the rest of it. But of course, there's going to have to be a court case, and then the court case, we're going to have to find out what actually happened, because of course the question with this, as with all such attacks, is did he act alone? And of course there was the original reports were that there was more than one shooter, and that there were bombs in vehicles.
Have you got
and
any
then,
evidence
then suddenly that was all clear
have
that
you got, now have we've got any one evidence wolf. Have you got any evidence that there was another shooter? Surely it was
well no the police at the time the first things that came, as you know, when these incidents happen, Tony, stuff comes out in the first few minutes which then gets airbrushed out, and then you get an agreed narrative about what happened, and we all think we know what happened. I mean, to be honest with you, if something like this happens, it would take the police quite a while to work out the series of events and all the rest of it. And it turned out, for example, that there was that the police who apprehended him were not the local police. They were a firearms unit which just happened to be doing something nearby. Now, I'm not saying we don't know enough to say anything firmly about this one way or the other. But given, you know, as you know, over many years we've looked into these incidents thoroughly, not just this one but previous ones, and we know that intelligence services around the world do engage in terrorism. In fact, most terrorism has the fingerprints of intelligence services all over it, and not, you know, different intelligence services, not necessarily the same ones. And lone gunmen like Oswald killing John F. Kennedy, or Sirhan supposedly killing Robert Kennedy, and you know, James Earl Ray supposedly killing Martin Luther King, although a jury in the US, North Carolina, has already concluded that he didn't, and somebody else was involved. We're suspicious about all these incidents, as we should be.
Those are political, those are kind of political terrorist acts, you know. I'm not quite sure what would be achieved, and you may be absolutely right, you know. I'm always a bit wary of conspiracy theories, because I think people who are willing to take part in a conspiracy can't keep their mouths shut, most probably, because they'll most probably be a bit too kind of...
Well, that's why a lot of them end up being killed, like, they don't get to try.
It's hard to keep it quiet, if you know what I mean, but I'm definitely not saying no, you know, absolutely, and I'm sure there is all sorts of awful stuff going on.
Well, nobody has a grudge against New Zealand.
And that's what I'm saying. What would be the reason I'm trying to...
We'll come to that now, okay?
Yeah, that's what I'm interested in.
We'll come to that
understand.
Now. I'm sure Tony will
so we've got a couple of incidents of bomb threats in New Zealand. Now, this is an Israeli autistic man has been sentenced to 10 years in jail for making thousands of bomb threats in New Zealand and other countries during 2016 and 2017. But more seriously, the Israeli Prime Minister in December 2016 told New Zealand's foreign minister that support for a UN resolution condemning Israeli settlement building in the occupied territories would be viewed as a declaration of war, according to reports in the Israeli medium. The Israeli PM has made these threats, so nobody apparently is threatening New Zealand apart from Israel. Well, why might that be, Martin?
Well, in Christchurch, during the earthquake some years ago, local police arrested Israeli intelligence agents who were trying to steal the identities of victims so that they could use that for, creating New Zealand passports, which their agents could then use around the world. And that's at the time the Israeli government were fed up and they withdrew their ambassador to Israel. And the Israelis were not very... New Zealand had a very, very frosty relationship.
Let's go have a little more detail there, because the body was found in Christchurch of someone that turned out to be an Israeli agent with stolen passports on.
Yeah.
And there were other people who were trying to get that body, and they were rather than being arrested, they were whisked off to the airport immediately by the Israeli ambassador to New Zealand.
Yeah.
So he actually got personally involved, managed to get these people together and got them out of the country very quickly, whereas actually the New Zealand police wanted to arrest them and question them.
Yeah. Now, when incidents like this happen, Tony, we've got to, you know, New Zealand has got a fantastic reputation in the world as being a sort of fair country with no enemies. And if you're a Mossad, you want those passports so you can go around the world pretending to be who you're not. And that's not the only case of Israeli agents trying to steal New Zealand passports. And the New Zealanders, of course, caught them out a couple of times, and I'm pretty fed up with it, because obviously
they like Canadian passports as well, because of the same reasons.
Which passport?
Canadians,
yeah.
Canadian
exactly.
passport. The same reasons. Good, healthy passport gets you into any country.
That's
kind
right.
of...
I mean, the guys that carried out the assassination on the Hamas guy in Qatar or whatever it was, in Dubai, I mean, they were all using passports, you know, false passports, basically. And it's very important if you're going to carry out assassinations and so on that you've got false identities to use.
They're not false. What makes them...
Well, they're real identities.
They're not forgeries. They're real identities, and that's what makes them so powerful.
Yeah. That's the idea, because penny's dropping now. So that's why they were at the earthquake, because these were real people.
Yes.
And they could use those identities, just pretend that they hadn't...
It's like a Hollywood movie, you know, somebody who, like, takes the name off a grave.
Well, one of the other things they did in New Zealand is they found people who were disabled and unlikely ever to travel, you know, people who lived in wheelchairs and were housebound, and they applied for passports in their name, yeah, pretending to be those people, yeah, and they were caught again by the New Zealand police. And, that's the way the world is, and therefore the motive to become... false flag terrorism isn't just conspiracy theory. I'm afraid it's been going on for a long time. The Gladio networks in Western Europe, which we've talked about quite a lot on this show, Fernando Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book coming out in 2012 called La Repubblica di Stragi Impuni, and he was the head of the Italian Supreme Court, pointing the finger firmly at NATO intelligence services for the bombing of Bologna, the assassination of Prime Minister Aldo Moro, the bombing of Piazza Fontana in 1969. People in educated people in Italy know very well that NATO intelligence services are terrorists, and they have been for a long time.
Well, I mean, there's so many examples, isn't there, of America, you know, going into South America, and Chile is one example. Yeah. And
well, that's the more overt stuff, if you like. Yeah. But they do lots of trickery, and they've got a huge infrastructure for doing it, and they've been caught out, and it's, people ought to realise that this is what's going on. And of course, I work quite regularly for Russia Today, as you know, and I can tell you right now, the Russian general staff are right up on top of all of this. They know exactly what's going on.
So you're having private meetings with the Russian?
I just work as a journalist for them, but I'm just pointing out.
That's not the Russian general staff. That's Russia Today editors and journalists.
That's indeed. But I'm pointing out that if you look at the statements by the Russians, General Ivashov, who is in command of the Russian armed forces on 9/11, is out there on the record saying, we know what happened there. That was carried out by the US
security
forces.
One thing that is not deniable in any way is the fact that at the same time as this attack in Christchurch, Israel was striking 100 targets in Gaza in response to rockets fired at Tel Aviv. The Israeli army assessed that militants mistakenly fired rockets at Tel Aviv during maintenance work.
Two rockets.
Yep, and in exchange, 100 went the other way. Can you just tell us what you make of that sort of thing? I mean, I can remember there was an attack, it was in Georgia, wasn't it? Actually, no, South Ossetia, at the same time as the, against the Russians, at the same time as the opening ceremony of the Chinese Olympics. So when there's a massive event that's going on, everyone's watching, sometimes something else is going on behind the scenes, and that was the case in Christchurch. At the same time, there was a 100 target rocket attack on Gaza, which we heard virtually nothing about.
Well, I mean, I don't think you can. I mean, there may be a linkage there, but I mean, the real point is that the message is being sent by the gangster elite in Israel is you don't mess. You know, we will put concrete boots on you if you cross us. And I think the New Zealand intelligence services may also have been implicated in some of this. You know, it's not clear that they are entirely on the right side. Anyway, they're part of the Five Eyes setup. Jacinda Ardern is obviously a decent person, but she doesn't necessarily control her own intelligence services.
Before we leave Gaza, what do you make of what's happening there, Mark?
Well, that's a big question. Can you be more specific?
Well, some call it a place where there are literally tens of thousands of terrorists. Others say it's more like a concentration camp.
No. Everywhere there are terrorists. You know, I mean, they're just up. Terrorists just went and massacred a bunch of people in Christchurch, and we got terrorists all over the place. And there are going to be people who will be willing to use violence in Israel, in Gaza, in Lebanon, and London, and in Bristol. Okay, so that's things. But Gaza is undoubtedly on the edge of being a concentration camp. It has been under siege for 12 years. It is, according to the UN reports and anybody who's been there and seen it, uninhabitable. In 2 years, the water will be undrinkable because of the sewage that's flowing into the system. So in a year and a half, 2 years, a mother will have to decide whether to kill her child quickly or slowly. The Israelis are turning on and off the electricity and the water supply at will whenever they feel like it. There are 60-70% unemployment. I have many friends in Gaza who I'm in contact with. They are past a point now they talk about suicide, but not suicide bombing, just suicide in general, because they see no purpose in life anymore. Gaza is a scar on the face of this earth, and all governments around the world are guilty of allowing it to carry on under our very noses. We have the criminal court in The Hague should be out doing much more. The United Nations, they release reports, so every country just throws it out the window and says we're not interested. Why? Because the security system that's, you know, tracked down Khashoggi from Saudi Arabia was built by Israel, and the security systems for monitoring people in the UK and in America are built by Israel. They want these toys, and they don't care. And if it's convenient, you know, and it's kind of a white imperialist male piece of madness going on. instead of dealing with the world and the problems that are coming, they're kind of pulling us back to the 19th and 20th century.
But it's not just Israelis doing this.
Not just Israelis.
I noticed there's a story in The Guardian this week, UK, US and Israel's surveillance obsession. So this is a fantastic amount of spyware being sold by the Brits. Human rights fury as UK licenses £75 million of spyware exports. The abuse of technology by autocratic regimes is being ignored, say campaigners.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely... It takes two to tango. Israel can only do what it does with impunity in Gaza because of the rest of the world, and specifically governments in the West or Western-style governments, allow them to get away with it. Everybody's, you know, in there trying to make a buck and use their new technology, and spyware is cool stuff to make and easy to make. It's just simple technology that armies... We have to remember that armies have been receiving budgets to develop computer technology from the 70s and the 60s and the 50s. They are way ahead of the curve. A lot of the people come out of the armies. It's very common in Israel. It's going to be common in the UK, common in America. They leave the armies with masses of knowledge. They're 25 years old. You know, they're picked up by high-tech companies. Their brain power is put to use, and people go out there and exploit the situation.
But we're sleepwalking into some kind of 1984 world.
Well, we're sleepwalking into a world where we're dealing with stuff which is irrelevant, because if we don't deal with climate change, there's going to be nothing here at all anyway in another 30 years. So what does it matter?
Okay, so let's have a look now at the Rothschild family. I'm really prompted to do this by a video by Momentum. And in fact, we had Jackie Walker on this programme a few weeks ago, who was removed as the deputy head of Momentum with allegations of anti-Semitism. But Momentum is now very much promoting things which are explaining, apparently, anti-Semitic tropes. Now, I'll just ask both of you, you first, Martin, explain, what is an anti-Semitic trope?
Well, a trope just means a figure of speech, as it were. And I suppose what's meant by this is that if we say that the Rothschilds are an extremely wealthy family who've had their fingers in many pies for many, many years, that's seen as anti-Semitic. But as far as I'm concerned, that's just anti-Rothschild. I mean, I'm not very keen on J.P. Morgan either. I don't like Rupert Murdoch. I don't care really what people's religious beliefs are, but if they're criminals, they're criminals. And if they're badly behaved, they're badly behaved. Behave, don't they?
It's really interesting. It goes back to, I agree with you, first of all, Martin, 100%, okay? But it's really interesting where it comes from and why this association, and we've had this conversation, we touched on it before, Tony. The in Europe, in the Middle Ages and onwards, into the Renaissance and up into the Industrial Revolution, until there was kind of civil and equal rights for Jews and many other ethnic groups who were considered second-class citizens in Europe up until, you know, the 18th century, the Jews in Europe fundamentally were only allowed to engage in trade and money-type stuff. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that they wanted to. They weren't allowed to own land. They weren't allowed to be aristocrats. They weren't allowed to be in politics. So they were kind of shoveled into this very small bandwidth of what they were allowed to do. Okay, so when you focus all your energy, add to that that within Jewish life, all the kids learn to read and write, and they're going to have 10, 12 kids. You're going to have three or four going to be really bright and able to use it, and you're going to have a higher percentage of people who can go out and do stuff because they're literate compared to the neighbors, most of whom aren't literate. So you have this weird circumstance come about where the Jews of Europe were only allowed to basically engage in money. That's why The Merchant of Venice was written, of course, and that's the association with Sherlock and what have you, and he's a Jew and all of that. And out of that, we got these families and the Rothschilds, and they're not the only family. The Rothschilds are most famous, who were good in that field, and they became really good at banking and trading. They also had a kind of, I kind of call it like a Jewish internet. They weren't, you know, they were moving between cities and they went into their little Jewish communities and they were supported and looked after so they could move and travel. And that's why the diamond business is so powerful amongst the Jews. They could travel safely between their small protected communities. But what stuck to that was the stigma of the Sherlock and this whole Jewish thing, which was an Shylock. This stigma of this Jewish and money thing being connected, and that's what's hanging over when we see the Rothschilds. So, of course, they should be treated as people who are rich, and either we agree with what they do or don't agree with what we do. We do need to recognize that stuff has stuck to them because of a history of persecution over a thousand odd years.
One of the key things in this Momentum video is denying that the Rothschild family in London, with Nathan Rothschild being the first banker who was sent over here in the 1700s, late 1700s, 1800s, that he made his money from the Battle of Waterloo. And I looked into this because I'd seen some evidence on both sides. If you go online, you'll find evidence on both sides. But it seems pretty clear to me that it was tested in court back in the early part of the 1900s, and the Rothschild family brought a court case against someone who was publishing a book which was telling this story, and lost, and got told to pay all the compensation for it.
But anyway, who lost?
The Rothschilds lost.
Okay.
So anyway, so let's have a little listen now to this story about the Rothschilds making their money out of the Battle of Waterloo, as told by Bill Still in his film The Money Masters.
This is the Waterloo battlefield about 200 miles northeast of Paris in what today is Belgium. Here, Napoleon suffered his final defeat, but not before thousands of French and Englishmen gave their lives on a steamy summer day in July of 1815. Right over there, on June 18, 1815, 74,000 French troops met 67,000 troops from Britain and other European nations. The outcome was certainly in doubt. In fact, had Napoleon attacked a few hours earlier, he would probably have won the battle. But no matter who won or lost, back in London, Nathan Rothschild planned to use the opportunity to try to seize control over the British stock and bond market, and possibly even the Bank of England. Rothschild stationed a trusted agent, a man named Rothworth, on the north side of the battlefield, closer to the English Channel.
Once the battle had been decided, Rothworth took off for the Channel. He delivered the news to Nathan Rothschild a full 24 hours before Wellington's own courier. Rothschild hurried to the stock market and took up his usual position in front of an ancient pillar. All eyes were on him. The Rothschilds had a legendary communications network.
If Wellington had been defeated and Napoleon was loose on the continent again, Britain's financial situation would become grave indeed.
Rothschild looked saddened. He stood there motionless, eyes downcast. Then suddenly he began selling.
Other nervous investors saw that Rothschild was selling. It could only mean one thing. Napoleon must have won, Wellington must have lost. The market plummeted. Soon everyone was selling their consols, their British government bonds, and prices dropped sharply. But then Rothschild started secretly buying up the consols through his agents for only a fraction of their worth hours before.
Myths, legends, you say? 100 years later, the New York Times ran a story which said that Nathan's grandson had attempted to secure a court order to suppress a book with this stock market story in it. The Rothschild family claimed the story was untrue and libelous, but the court denied the Rothschild's request and ordered the family to pay all court costs.
Well, there's the story, and this is the version of it that you get in this recent Momentum video, which has been produced by Michael Walker.
If you, like me, spend a lot of time online, you'll probably have come across a lot of claims about the Rothschilds, that they have amassed 80% of the world's wealth, that they control every central bank in the world other than Russia's, and that they're responsible for instigating wars and controlling governments. The problem is, none of this is actually true. The Rothschilds were a wealthy banking family in the 19th century, but that was a long time ago. And now their descendants are scattered across the world with little in common other than a surname. Some of these people are rich, but nowhere near the levels of wealth of the richest people in the world today. Benjamin de Rothschild, a French businessman, has a net worth of $1.7 billion. But he's the only Rothschild in the Forbes rich list at number 1,121. And the world's richest man, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, is worth 65 times that. The closest thing to any Rothschild family business today is the Rothschilds Group Investment Banking Company. They have annual profits of $70 million. But the world's largest company, Walmart, makes more than $120 billion annually. That's almost 2,000 times as much. And central banks like the Bank of England are, of course, state institutions and have nothing to do with any Rothschilds. But why does this matter? Whether Benjamin de Rothschild is at number one in the world or at number 1,001, he can probably look after himself, right? It matters because this is a historic anti-Semitic trope that blames the world's problems not on capitalism or structural inequalities, but on conspiracies by secretive Jews. This is one of the peculiar aspects of anti-Semitism that some of us on the left are not so instinctively used to. Whereas many racisms punch down, calling other peoples inferior, anti-Semitism casts Jews as powerful overlords, conspiring and manipulating behind the scenes.
You want to bring down the cultural fabric of America. You're a Jew.
The Rothschilds family were Jewish and have featured in these anti-Semitic conspiracies since the 19th century, when Nathan Meyer Rothschild faced false accusations of profiteering from the Napoleonic Wars. Today, the trope of the conspiratorial Jew is often applied to George Soros, the Hungarian Jewish Holocaust survivor and liberal investor, cast by right-wingers as the Jew behind the scenes manipulating world events and even falsely accused of being a Nazi collaborator himself.
Who's the puppet master?
The term Zionist is used, not as part of a discussion about the situation in Israel and Palestine, or about the history of Zionism as an idea and a movement, but simply as code for Jews who control things. From the Zionist occupation government theory of fascists like Nick Griffin.
There is a disproportionate number of Jews involved in all levels of the mass media.
To the Rothschild Zionists of David Icke, and claims that Zionists control Western finance, politics, and media. And that's how you end up with memes like this, with a Rothschild, Soros, and others depicted as globalists, Zionists, or something else, all people who just happen to be Jewish. And if you find this video useful, please send it to friends who aren't aware of these tropes. Let's make clear that Jews are always welcome in the labour movement, and anti-Semitism isn't.
I suppose I should ask you, first of all, Mark, what you make of that. I mean, really he's presenting two apparent anti-Semitic tropes there, one about the Rothschilds, and the other one, which I was quite surprised to hear, is that the Zionist trope, which is apparently the word is code for Jews who control things.
Oh, well, the word Zionist has been twisted and turned around so much over the last 100 years that it's really hard, you know, to know really what it represents. For many people, Zionist and Jew goes hand in hand. You know, I'm basically an anti-Zionist, but I'm a Jew and I'm an Israeli. So it's become a code word amongst kind of extremist organizations to mean Jew. As far as I don't really know how to move forward from there, if that makes sense.
Okay, so what about the? I mean, for example, saying that this is a. I mean, I've just told the story. I mean, maybe. I mean, some people might accuse me of being anti-Semitic for just telling that story. He says that this thing about making money out of the Napoleonic Wars is a false accusation, and yet, if you look in the New York Times, I mean, I've just done a bit of research on it. Apparently, in the April 1st, 1915 edition, reported that Baron Nathan Meyer Rothschild had attempted to secure a court order to suppress a book written by Ignatius Baller entitled The Romance of the Rothschilds on the grounds the Waterloo story about his grandfather was untrue and libelous. The court ruled the story was true, dismissed the suit, and ordered Rothschild to pay all the court fees.
Yeah, but
another thing he's talking about in there is, oh, they're not on the rich list. But we know from Kevin Cahill, who sits in this studio from time to time, about once a month at the moment, that there's a lot of people who are super rich and spend quite a lot of time making sure they're not on the rich list, including the Queen, who threatened to sue the Sunday Times unless she was removed from the rich list, saying that the Crown Estates were not part of her property, even though she can buy and sell land on the Crown Estates at any time she wants, that there are ways of actually making the rich list not include, and there are also ways of hiding wealth. It's very easy to hide
that's
your
got
wealth.
Nothing to do with being Jewish, though.
No, but what I'm saying,
that whole point, this whole connection with the Jewish thing is a load of rubbish. It's like, you know, some people happen to be Jewish, some people, I mean, the richest guy in the world, Croesus, was a West African black guy. You know, he spread out so much gold, he gave away so much gold when he went on the Hajj to Mecca, that the price of gold was devalued for about 100 years, you know. The whole whole thing is this connecting up, and we even the conversation is childish and stupid, because what we're doing is, I mean, I respect you and the need to bring it out, but what we're doing is we're perpetuating this myth that people can buy into. People will believe what they want to believe. It's really simple. People want to think, you know, the Jews control the world. We could lay it out for them however we want. They're always going to believe that because it's convenient for them. You know, people want to believe that Barack Obama shouldn't be president of the United States because he wasn't born in America. You know, they say whatever, including the present president.
So Martin, this is genuinely associated with people with Nazi ideas too, isn't it?
Well, look, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that anti-Semitism is completely unacceptable. But naming the Rothschilds, they are one of the powerful families that rules the world, but they're not the only one, as has just been pointed out. And of course, there's plenty of poor Jews. That's what's going about them. And you know, the people who worked in the textile industry.
You're looking at one right now, by the way.
The old Jews are rich is absurd, you know.
So what I'd like to do now is I did talk to the jazz musician Gilad Atzmon about this, and this is what he had to say after having watched this Momentum video.
My name is Gilad Atzmon. I'm a musician and a writer. I write about Jewish identity politics, and I play jazz in between. My issue with this Momentum's conspiracy video is it is there to set boundaries of correctness of what we are allowed to talk about and what is it that we should never mention. Now, there may be an argument that the Rothschilds are not as influential as they used to be. However, in the film, we learned that we shouldn't talk about the Rothschild, and we should talk about George Soros. And it is quite surprising because, according to our basic understanding of working class politics and the left operation, we are supposed to be against bankers and capitalists, but somehow certain kind of capitalists we are not allowed to mention. What do those two capitalists have in common? They're Jews. So I assume that we are allowed to be critical of bankers and capitalists unless they are Jews, which means that in the eyes of Momentum or Labour, if I'm saying Labour because Corbyn was very happy to endorse this film, Jewish bankers are in a privileged position in British Labour in 2019.
There were a lot of conspiracy theories to do with the Rothschilds saying that they are controlling Europe, if not United States as well, through their wealth. But those, surely there has to be an end to those sorts of conspiracy theories.
Okay, I'm not an expert on financial affairs, and I cannot comment on questions whether these are conspiracies or not, what is the influence of the Rothschild in the Federal Reserve and so on. But I can tell you something else. I'm working on Jewish history, I'm working on Jewish identity politics, and I recently, a year ago, and it was in 2017, it's probably a year and a half ago, we had all those celebrations around the Balfour Declaration. And within the context of the celebration of the Balfour Declaration, 100 years for the Balfour Declaration, I saw an interview with an elder Rothschild. They were influential enough in the eyes of the Jewish community here and the Zionist Federation. They were influential enough to be at the core of this story. And why? Because apparently it was Rothschild who was the engineer, the guy who orchestrated this Balfour Declaration. So the attempt of Momentum to wipe the Rothschild out of the history books is slightly pathetic.
Well, one of the things they say is that Rothschild is really a code for anti-Semitism for having a go at all now, Jews.
Now, this is something that they have to substantiate. But there is something, when I saw the video, there is something that I have to tell you, and your listeners don't know, I assume. And it's something that I grew up, it's not due to my scholarship, I just grew up in Israel as an Israeli secular Jew. The song, If I Were a Rich Man, do you know the song? If I Were a Rich Man. Yeah, it's a song that a lot of people of our generation know. This song, originally, in Hebrew and in Yiddish, you can find if you look, If I Were a Rothschild, you will find the song. This song originally was written as If I Were a Rothschild. If I Were a Rothschild, or in Hebrew, Lu Haiti Rothschild, 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 yeah? Which means, and this is something that is very crucial, that within the context of Jewish culture, and this is something that maybe doesn't apply anymore, to become a Rothschild or to be a Rothschild, it was an aspiration for all Jews, and definitely Jews in the East, in the Pale area. And this is exactly the story of Fiddler on the Roof.
Well, that's an interesting little take on the Jewish history, isn't it?
But he's
it?
Talking also about Walter Rothschild there, back in 1917. He was the architect of the Balfour
Declaration. Well, yeah, I think what you've got to recognise is that people like Sheldon Adelson, for example, in the US, who owns masses of casinos in Macau and Las Vegas and so on, biggest funder of US politics, he's very firmly pro-Israel. And, you know, these are very... George Soros less so. I mean, I think the Israeli government rather dislike his interventions because he tends to be more, liberal-minded in his politics.
Okay.
And I think the fact is that Jews have got all very varied politics, but many wealthy Jews are very strongly supportive of the State of Israel and its reactionary policies.
I think we're going to have to leave some of the stuff till next week. But I think I'll finish with this... I mean, this whole business of the Christian Zionists in the United States... I think is so important to understand what is being said in order to sort of boost the whole sort of fueling of the whole Zionist thing in the US. And when you start to unpick it, it gets pretty frightening. So we're going to have a listen now. And this is certainly not something that this show endorses in any way. But it's a Christian Zionist pastor called John MacArthur. And this is what he says about the whole... Islam, he's talking about here the Islamic prophecies of the end of the world and the Christian prophecies of the end of the world. So we'll have a minute or so just to have a listen to that at the very end, or to discuss what we're about to hear, which is one of the Christian Zionist bits of philosophy that they've taken out of the Bible, which I can tell you I certainly do not, as a Christian, agree with at all.
In Islamic eschatology, there are three great signs of the end of history. Three great signs. There are some lesser signs, or some minor signs, and some major signs. In their eschatology, again, quoting their sources exclusively, there are three great signs of the end of history. And each of them is a man. The first man that will come in the end of history is the Mahdi, M-A-H-D-I. Sometimes he's called the 12th Imam. Every time Ahmadinejad over in Iran gives a speech, he says, glory to the Mahdi, glory to the 12th Imam. Every time. He's waiting for the coming of the Mahdi. What is he coming to do? He's coming, listen carefully, to slaughter all who will not worship Allah, convert to Islam. They are identified in their writings as pigs and dogs, and to establish the everlasting, world-dominating kingdom of Islam. That's what he will do. The Mahdi, or the 12th Imam, that means the guided one, is the long-awaited savior. He is the establisher of the final caliphate. The world must follow him as he takes over, or he will destroy all enemies of Islam. He will come and he will carry on holy war, and either you convert or you're killed by the Mahdi. He will have an army. His army will be a massive army, and his army will go from nation to nation to punish the unbelievers. The holy writings of Islam say that this army will carry black flags. And on those black flags, there'll be one word, and that one word will be the word punishment. By the way, the Iranian army today carries black flags. They want to be ready for the coming of the Mahdi. He will lead the army of black flags first to Israel, slaughter all the Jews, and then he will establish his rule in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount. That's what their literature says.
Now, that's he's a Christian Zionist pastor. His name is John MacArthur. I wonder what, I'll ask you first, Mark, what you make of that, because this is the kind of stuff, I mean, he's basically saying, look, Islam is a killer faith, they're black flags, and they are hell-bent on destroying Israel.
Wasn't there a period of time in history when some guys called the Crusaders went right across the world in the name of God and, you know, slaughtering anything in their path and wanting to take over Jerusalem? So it's a pretty old story, just reinvented. Most of this stuff, I don't know enough about Islam, I'm going to keep it really short. I've read bits some pieces, but 99% of the stuff that we get spouted at us, be it from Christianity, from Judaism, and from the monotheistic religions, is interpretations and commentary. And that's what they're reading from. People can make up whatever they want, twist anything. If you want to buy into it, buy into it. Mm. It's about buying into hate.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Martin. That's just his interpretation of the Quran. I'm sure he's not ever been exposed to any real criticism.
Well, I mean, the obvious point to make is that the black flags are carried by Wahhabis, who are strict Sunnis, and the 12th Imam is basically an idea of the Shia, and the Shia and the Sunnis don't agree about this, so he's conflated the two things together as if they're the same, when in actual fact it's the Iranians who've been fighting in Syria against the Wahhabis, who are supported by Saudi Arabia, who are Israel's allies. Isn't that amazing?
But, I mean, this is a really poisonous kind of conflation, isn't it? A poisonous kind of...
It's basically ignorance.
Yeah, but it's
any,
not.
Any Muslim would know immediately that that's just demonstrating complete ignorance of Islam.
But the poison is there. These people are now, including Trump, has just recognised the Golan Heights for Israel, for example.
Well, Mike Pence, the vice president, who will take over if Trump is assassinated, is a fundamentalist Christian Zionist. There you go.
Okay, well, I'll put a link up to our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. You'll find this show's podcasts and story links at thisweek.org.uk, and I'll put a link up to that last interview too. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. Thanks very much to Martin Summers and Mark Smullyan there.
From the Sky News Centre.